You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Thanks so much to the thousands of you guys that have been tuning in so far in the first few weeks of the new podcast. We really appreciate it. And if you want to support the show even more, be sure that you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Today, I have a really great guest for you, Steve Forbes, Editor-in-Chief of Forbes Media. Steve, thanks so much for coming on.
Brad, good to be with you. Thank you.
To get our conversation going, I'd like to kind of flash back to March, right after the coronavirus pandemic hit America and, you know, sent us into a tailspin. We'd really never dealt with anything like this, certainly in my lifetime. So obviously, the pandemic and the kind of draconian lockdown measures sent the economy into a tailspin. But then we went in and we decided to respond to it, especially in Congress, with a giant big government legislation called the CARES Act. I want to ask you about all the specifics, but just broadly, do you think that was the right approach?
Well, in terms of since the government shut down the economy because of the pandemic and therefore harmed individuals and businesses, not because of any mistakes they made, but because suddenly you're slammed against the wall, I wouldn't call it stimulus or CARES. I would just call it a lifeline. It's like getting insurance after a storm or something like that. Unfortunately, they put a lot of junk in there instead of doing the individual checks and providing assistance to small businesses. And they made mistakes such as saying in terms of payroll protection that it had to go 75% for payroll. But if you're a restaurant or something and 50% of your costs is rent, they should have had much more flexibility there. So, yes, you go big. It's like after an earthquake or something like that. Go big, try to get things moving and get it back on track. Putting an extra $500 a week on unemployment benefits ended up having a perverse impact. And I hope we don't make that mistake again. And that's why I did not oppose and would not oppose a big check to individuals. They did one $1,000 and I think $500 for dependents last March and April. And I wouldn't have mind doubling it because even though it costs money, it is an emergency lifeline and it's a one shot. It does not distort the labor markets. It's just a one shot. It's like getting an insurance payment. It's a one shot. Then you go about repairing your finances and whatever.
So let me ask you about those checks, and then I want to talk about the unemployment as well in just a minute. But the checks that were sent out, I believe it was $1,200 to most Americans, kind of indiscriminate of need. And so for me, I question that approach from the get-go, right? Because people like me, I'm a journalist. I was able to work remotely with ease, and my income wasn't disrupted. Why did it make sense to send checks regardless of need instead of sending checks for more money just to those that were affected?
Well, in terms of, I think they did have some income limits, and I know they get income limits on if they do another round, 75 for an individual, 150,000 for a couple. And the reason for the seemingly indiscriminate nature of it, it was an emergency, like wartime. You just try to get it out there as fast as possible, limit the damage that's out there. And it also did impact a lot of people who, even if they didn't become unemployed, had their own possibilities of advancement and doing things disrupted. I know in our own company, we do a lot of live events, especially in the fourth quarter, third quarter, and boy, those went out the window in the springtime pretty quickly. So when in that kind of acute emergency, I get less hung up on did we do it precisely, because if the government tries to target it, they're just going to mess it up. So get it out there, realize it's a one-time thing, and then focus on how do you create an environment where we get this economy back on track again? And that's what should be the focus, especially in taxes and regulation, and don't undermine the integrity of the dollar.
So that you raise a good point, because the way they did do it, they actually ended up sending billions of dollars in checks to dead people, which I think they'll be able to reclaim most of the money, but that kind of shows you just how efficient government can be when it's working quickly.
Yeah, after the disaster, you can clean it up and try to root out the fraud of, sadly, human nature being what it is. There is some, but also should have been a cautionary tale about indiscriminate mailing of ballots. Hello?
Yeah, that could become pretty relevant pretty soon. But I guess, so I don't disagree with you at all that the government, when they basically do a takings, right, by shutting people's businesses down, that they have an obligation to compensate people. So I don't think it's necessarily welfare or socialism. Your point's fully taken. But whether it worked is another question. So kind of the idea behind the checks, at least from some of the advocates, maybe not all, but some, was kind of a Keynesian idea that they would stimulate consumer spending. But some of the numbers since show that only about 40% of the money was actually spent. So what do you make of that?
Well, first of all, it reminds me of Nancy Pelosi, I think a decade ago, saying unemployment benefits stimulate the economy, which by her logic, the more people you have unemployed, the more stimulus you have. And the other thing is, in terms of stimulating the economy, the idea that consumer spending drives the economy, consumer spending is the end result of people producing things. And one of the things that I hope we get in the next few years is greater recognition of a better measurement of the economy. We all focus on GDP, which is really final sales. What it ignores is all that goes into making those final sales. It ignores B2B spending. Hello. It ignores what goes into a supply chain. It's like taking a carton of milk at the supermarket and thinking it just shows up. It ignores the cow, the milking of the cow, pasteurizing the milk, delivering the milk, packaging the milk, delivering the milk, and ignores everything in it. So there's a measurement out there that the BEA, Bureau of Economic Analysis, which issues these things, the GDP numbers every quarter, called GO, gross output, a gross name, but that's what they have. The British call it total output, which I think is a more accurate measure. And what that shows is totally contradicts this idea that sending consumers checks stimulates the economy, other than a one shot. It shows that the key driver to the economy, no surprise, is business spending and investment. Right. Far bigger than consumer spending, far, far bigger than government. Government does not create resources. All government do is take resources. You debate right. about what they do with those resources, but they don't create resources. So we need a better measurement. So again, the advocates who say this will stimulate the economy, no, this is like dealing with an emergency. And Bastiat, years ago, 150 years ago, pointed out, yeah, you break a window, it seems to have a stimulus effect, but it ignores all the things that you lost in dealing with the window instead of doing other things.
Right. It's funny. I saw a meme, a funny picture on Twitter yesterday where they had a guy standing in a wheelbarrow full of money and taking a shovel and scooping it from one side and moving it to the other. And then he was labeled government. And he said, look, I stimulated the economy. And I think that's kind of a fun kind of mini version of what you're describing, which brings us to the matter of the expanded unemployment benefits during the CARES Act. So for listeners who don't know exactly how it worked, the CARES Act, basically, we already have state level unemployment programs that pay out $250 a week, $500 a week, whatever it may be in that state. The CARES Act created a federal supplement to that of $600 a week on top of that. And so under that system, we actually had over 70% of recipients collecting more on benefits than they did earning in their normal job. The idea from kind of progressives or Keynesians was that, well, this will keep consumer spending up and it will keep the economy alive. But obviously it creates a work disincentive, doesn't it?
It did indeed. And again, it was one thing if you did something perhaps a little less for a few weeks when at the most acute stage, and then undo it. Instead, they put it through the end of July. So that hurt the pace of the recovery. A lot of employers were ready to hire, but they couldn't find people to do it. Some people did it anyway because they wanted to get their careers back on track, but it was a perverse incentive. No surprise, the Democrats are insisting on doing it again. They're insisting on this latest round, $500 a week. And that's, again, where I see politics being what it is. I would say no to that, but do a big one-time individual check. That's one time, does not distort the market. And that way we can get a recovery. And the key thing about all these debts that we've been running up is, again, creating the environment where we grow the assets of the economy faster than the liabilities. What we did after World War II, we had a national debt, higher then proportion to the economy than we had today. But we did things more right than wrong. And by the late 60s, before we started to really muck up again, early 70s, that had fallen from over 120% of GDP down to around 35. So you don't have to wreck the economy to pay the debts. You just have to make sure you have assets, which, again, assets reduce the burden of a liability.
So you make a good point, and I think it's interesting to consider. One thing that I think free marketeers or libertarians or conservatives can kind of do is just be the nomad, right? Where they just kind of constantly criticize everything, but don't always, and not you or me, because we're great. But in general, they can just shoot down a lot of things without always providing another alternative. So I guess it's in your vision, I've heard some interesting ideas. You know, Stephen Moore had a Wall Street Journal op-ed out today about just waiving the whole income tax for a year and how that would have been a free market way to stimulate the economy and get people huge work incentive, not disincentive. And yes, it would cost money from the Treasury and reduce tax revenue, and that would increase the deficit or whatever, but at least you're not putting it in the hands of government bureaucrats to try to run a stimulus program and waste it and send checks to dead people. So I guess I'm curious, what would your vision, if you had been, you know, whispering in Trump's ear and somehow Nancy Pelosi had gone along with what you had to say, unfortunately, she probably wouldn't have, but for this hypothetical, right, what would you have picked as a couple free market ways to stimulate the economy?
Well, you hit on it, especially the payroll tax. A lot of people don't pay income tax, but every dollar you earn, you pay that payroll tax, which employer employees about, I think, 15.3%, half by employer, half by employee. So if you're making $40,000 a year, that would mean a $3,000 raise suspending that. It would also mean it costs the employer $3,000 less to hire you or keep you on the payroll. So that is true win-win all around, which is why a lot of us were advocating with the White House to do that in another round. And unfortunately, the president tried to do it by executive order, but the Treasury Department undermined it. And and Congress wouldn't consider it. So I wish they had made a real issue of it. Here was a win-win thing for everybody, employers, employees, and you don't have to worry about whether you're paying income tax or not. Suspending the income tax for a year, I wouldn't mind that at all, in the sense that it would create an appetite for something like the flat tax and something simple. And I think we're going to have an environment for major reform. I don't know whether we're going to get it next year. If the elections go badly, then I think we're going to start to create the conditions of it in the 2022 elections, because there's no way you can take a recovering economy, one that's been really body slammed, and wind knocked out of it, and then pile on the taxes that Joe Biden and the Democrats, the far left, are talking about, and not have bad results. And at best, they can just hope for sluggish European growth rates of, you know, 0.9% a year. But the American people aren't going to tolerate that. And that's why one of the things that has to be done in the months and years ahead is not just fight political battles, but fight the intellectual battles, so that when the opportunity comes, we are ready. We're ready to go with the ideas. And that was not true after the 2008 crisis. We were on defense on that morally, and I don't want to see that happen again.
Yeah, it's a good point. We are caught on defense too much. And I want to talk about your criticisms of a potential Biden presidency, because you said something that really interested me in one of your interviews that I was looking at kind of before inviting you on, where you said that Biden's presidency would be an unmitigated disaster for the economy. And kind of just to put devil's advocate on for a moment, I mean, but he's a moderate Democrat, Steve. I mean, he's the moderate one. He's not going to
anything crazy. Paraphrasing a former president depends on how you define moderate. And his whole, even though he may seemingly have a moderate demeanor because he likes to talk and, you know, be friendly, doesn't mean his views are moderate. They're not. And so he's always been more liberal than he's looked. You saw what he did to Clarence Thomas in those hearings, for example, 30 years ago, or to Robert Bork before that. So there's not much moderate in demeanor doesn't mean moderate in policy. And the way he's reacted to the rise of the far left in the party, the new socialism, shows that he does not, nor does his running mate, Kamala Harris, have the backbone or the inclination to fight the left wing of the party. So you normally, when you sew up a nomination, you try to go to the center. And instead, he sits down for so-called unity talks with Bernie Sanders, an avowed socialist. And right. They came up with a 110-page monstrosity that they sort of hope nobody looks at. But it's all spelled out in there. Far more control over our lives, far, far less freedom for people, and far less opportunity for people to get ahead. It would keep people perpetually poor.
I'm glad you brought up Kamala Harris because, you know, we all wish Joe Biden good health if he is elected president. But we have to talk about the fact that he is not a spring chicken. And like any presidency, especially when they're older, your VP selection really matters. And even if Biden does have good health, which we all hope happens, she'll be the front runner for 2024. How does Kamala Harris seem to you in terms of how far left is she economically?
She's shown that when she looks at it, it's not her prime interest. She'll go as far left as they want her. There was no pushback, no modulation that would indicate, hey, we got these people here, I got to deal with them, but I don't want them wrecking things. None of that at all. And so the fact that she doesn't appear to have the kind of principled anchor or guideposts, guardrails, that would have her say, oh, this is going too far. I got to figure out politically how to deal with it within my own party. Instead, they want it, fine. And so I don't look for her as any kind of a barrier at all, any kind of roadblock, road bump at all on the party's fast-paced journey to the Netherlands of socialism and communism.
So a counter question I want to ask you is, obviously the markets enjoy and react positively to, in many cases, stability. And you can say a lot of things about Donald Trump, but he's not the most stable man in the country, right? With firing off a tweet that could send the markets into uproar, et cetera. Do you think that the markets would respond positively or that some people on Wall Street might like the idea of a Biden-Harris presidency just because it's more conventional, it's more stable? You know what to expect?
Well, you may not get the fireworks that you would get from Donald Trump. And by the way, like anything, once the novelty passes, you sort of get used to it and know how to process it. And they ended up getting a lot of substantive things done, especially in the non-glamorous areas. You think Donald Trump would just be about glamour and glitter and all that. But the nitty-gritty stuff in terms of deregulation in several agencies has been very real. Mm-hmm. That's why. And so in terms of Biden and Harris, on the surface, they may seem more calm, but they would be decidedly stormy in what they'd do to the economy. It's sort of like a hurricane with a nice smile on it. A nice meme on a hurricane doesn't get around the fact that it's destroying everything around it.
So to ask you for a couple specifics, what are two or three specific policies or policy issues you think they would be destructive on?
Oh, well, let's start. We mentioned the capital gains tax. That is a tax on savings and capital, the essence of an economy. And by the way, every time it's been raised in the past, it always disappoints on revenue because you just don't realize it. Every time in the past we reduce the rate, you get more revenue because people are less hesitant to realize gains from the past. So it puts capital to work. It unfreezes it. Raising the personal income tax rate, highest rate, they're going to put the Social Security taxes. You know, the current Social Security tax goes away at, I think, $138,000 a year. If you make more than $400,000, which were their inflationary policies would get a lot of people to pretty quickly, you're suddenly looking at a marginal rate, as they call it, the highest tax rate, going from the current 37-39% to as high as 55%, and depending on the state you live in, 65%, 67%. It is a catastrophe. Again, well, the rich have money. The rich have resources, and if those resources are ill-treated or there's no environment that entices those resources to be put to productive use, risk-taking use to learn things and move ahead, we're going to have stagnation, just as we did back in the 1970s. Raising the business tax from 21 to 28%. They say, well, that's not so bad. It was once 35. Well, when it was 35, guess what happened? capital was fleeing overseas. Companies were changing their address from here to overseas because of the stupidity. And when they reduced it down to 21, things started to redress themselves. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying, aha, it worked at 21, let's see what more good could be done, say at 15, they go in the opposite direction. Oh, we're giving the patient antibiotics. The patient's getting better. Let's take the antibiotics away because obviously the patient doesn't need them. You know, it's that kind of silly stuff. And then what they do on the regulatory side, on the environmental side, this whole thing of cronyism on so-called alternative energies, where if you look at the true environmental costs of all the materials that go into one of those windmills, all the steel, rare earth materials and the like, which use child labor in places like Congo and other mm-hmm. parts of the world, when you look at the true ecosystem behind these alternative energies, it turns pretty ugly pretty quickly. And there's no way, given the physics involved, even if we get solar panels cheaper and cheaper, no way could begin to meet the energy needs of an economy today. And by the way, if they want true alternative energies, two areas to look at. One is nuclear power, not the traditional nuclear power we think of today, but another kind of nuclear power called molten salt technology that was actually experimented with in the 1950s. The Air Force was using it to perhaps have nuclear-powered airplanes like we had nuclear-powered submarines, but using a different technology. They dropped it when they went for missiles because that obviated the need for long-distance airplanes flying forever. But the technology is there, and it's starting to come back to life again in all places of Canada. Who would have thought Canada? Why? Because the regulators there, I'm not sure Trudeau knew, the prime minister knows this, but the regulators have taken, which we should do everywhere here, a principles-based approach. That is, you put out what you want in terms of safety and effectiveness, and you, the producer, figure out how to do it, which means you get a lot of innovation, a lot of experimentation to see what truly works. So don't be, and now our regulators apparently are taking note of it, which is a good thing, our nuclear regulators. And the other thing is, it looks like that fusion, which is, you know, has the same moniker as Brazil, great future and always will. But it looks like that fusion is now making some breakthroughs. So if you really right. want real alternative energies, let's look at real viable ones like molten salt, like fusion that can provide huge amounts of energy at a cheaper cost. And unlike these alternatives like windmills and solar panels, does not degrade the environment.
Right. So very good points. But I guess one thing that maybe you could explain is people in the media and kind of activists and even just general everyday folks tend to kind of conflate who technically has to pay a tax with who bears its real costs. So a lot of people look at Joe Biden and they say, oh, he's just going to raise taxes on corporations and people who make over $400,000. That's not me. That's not my family. Does that mean they have nothing to worry about, or could it still hurt them?
Well, last I looked, most people are employed by businesses. Government employees depend on a healthy economy to get the resources to pay their salaries and benefits. So as we saw in the recovery, sluggish recovery from 2008, when we piled on regulations and taxation, ostensibly mostly on banks and others, we had stagnation, which hurt job creation, hurt wage growth. And we saw it most especially in the 1970s. Where we had that kind of stagnation. So you make it, this is where the gross output is so important. You make it hard, it's like saying, well, we're just gonna tax the carpenter and the builder. Well, if you do that, it's eventually gonna affect the building of the house, and you're gonna have less house, less shelter. So when you hurt businesses, that's gonna hurt your prospects for higher pay. It's going to hurt people who are going into the workforce, gaining the skills to move up the ladder in terms of employment. It's sluggish all around. And that's what they don't realize. Schumpeter, by the way, recognized that profit was not surplus. Profit was a cost of doing business in the sense that if you have a vibrant economy, you're always, as he put it, creative destruction. So right. you're destroying the old. So a steel mill that might have been worth $100 million today, new technology comes along, worthless, just scrap tomorrow. So you got to pay for the technological advances. You have to pay for all the experimentation that goes on to make advances possible. And you then have to pay, too, to keep the current stuff moving. You know, you have car repairs. It just doesn't run by itself. You got to make repairs on that. So all of that requires money and savings. So, yeah, you go after the so-called rich, and by golly, eventually they come after you, the middle class. You look at Europe. Where do they get the money for all the free stuff? Things like super taxes, like the VAT. We think state sales taxes of 6%, yuck. How about 25%? I mentioned payroll taxes earlier, but we have 15% here. In Europe, they range from 35 to 50%. That's how they get the wherewithal to pay for free stuff and why their growth rates, on average, are far lower than ours over time.
And their unemployment is consistently higher, partly because they have this expanded welfare state. And it's a good point that you bring up, because when I talk to young people, Democrats and progressives, they're like, well, we just want to be like Sweden. We just want to be like Denmark. And I'm like, well, the middle class pays 60% tax rates there. So you can't just tax the rich to get us there. But
by the way, they also ignored, how did Sweden and Denmark and these other places become so rich in the first place? When they had so-called laissez-faire free market economics. And then they thought, well, we can afford all this good stuff, and they overdid it. And Sweden, since the 1980s, 70s, has gone scaled back. And by the way, the Swedes don't think have a minimum wage. And among other things, they allow school choice. So the left has this fantasy of Sweden, which just doesn't comport with the real world. They've been going more in the direction of freedom, not socialism.
Right. It was interesting when they come out with like annual rankings of economic freedom, Denmark places higher than the United States in terms of their friendliness and openness to regulation and that sort of thing. Which brings me to one of the things I wanted to ask about the Trump administration and the Trump economic record, because it's just a fact that the economy was very good before the coronavirus came to our shores and threw a wrench in everything. You had record low unemployment for minorities. You had strong growth, the first real income rises. And actually, I saw data recently about how we were seeing growth in average household income, particularly in Hispanic and Black families. So what policy items from the Trump administration do you think most contributed to those successes?
I think it's a very basic. One is the tax cut. That was helpful. But the other was deregulation and not having people fear every morning, what are they going to do to me now? What are they going to do to me now? And on the banking side, it became less of a thing. You want to make a loan? Have you papered it 10 ways to Sunday? And so inhibit making loans to newer businesses, smaller businesses. And that started to have a very palliative effect on the economy. You started to see it for the first time in years, more new business formations. We went through a drought starting in the 90s. We used to create 800,000 new real businesses a year. That is, a business is going to hire somebody. Down to 500,000, even as the economy got bigger and the population got bigger. One of the great attributes, the Kauffman Foundation has done a lot of research on this, makes the American economy unique, is that we create 50 to 75 new big companies every generation.
Wow.
$1 billion plus, that come out of obviously small companies. So we don't have the big people like Germany's Siemens just around forever and ever getting bigger, which means sluggishness and bureaucracy, even though they try to do occasionally renew themselves. We come with the newbies. What was Google 25 years ago? It was an idea of a couple of PhD students, and Facebook, and all of these giants we have today. So what, instead of focusing on, gee, how do we bust these companies up, we should be focusing on creating an environment where the new Facebooks and Googles and the new technologies of the future. So you look at Microsoft, a big bad company crushing everybody, Octopus in the 90s. And guess what? The internet really rose up, and Microsoft struggled for a while, always profitable, but nothing like the giant that was eating up the world. It's doing well now. They're really into the cloud. but not the big bad monster they portrayed in the 1990s. So with free markets, that is people striving to find ways of doing new things in new ways. Hey, guess what? You don't have tenure in the marketplace. You may have it in the university, but you don't have it in the marketplace.
Right. And that's the creative disruption you mentioned. And you're not going to get any disagreement from me about how the free market deregulation grew the economy. One thing I want to ask you about, though.
And by the way, you hit on Latinos and African Americans. What's not realized today is that Latinos now are the biggest creators and have been for several years of new businesses, new business formations. Nobody knows it. So a very traditional story. Immigrants, and by golly, they soon become entrepreneurs. And African Americans, for the first time in decades, in the last 3 or 4 years, business formation startups started to move up. Obviously, it was smashed by COVID. But again, if you want to help people get ahead, create that environment, a lot of people want to start their business, and they don't look for an exit strategy. They want something permanent. They want to have their own place of business.
So, well, let me ask you about that then, because legal immigration and high-skilled immigration, and that tends to be very good for the economy in the view of a lot of economists, but President Trump generally opposes a lot of forms of legal immigration and wants to reduce immigration. Isn't that counterproductive for the economy?
Yeah, well, I think immigration reform was necessary because of what they call chain immigration, where you come here and you end up bringing anyone who knew you in grade school saying, oh, this is my cousin 25th removed. So kind of got out a little hand there. But having immigration, legal immigration, and allowing people to come in who want to get ahead, and not just people with PhDs and the like, you also have to have some slots for people who may not have much, want to come here and start and make something. Most people don't come here to go on welfare. Most of them come here because they figure they have a chance to get ahead. And the very coming here means they have probably a more higher risk level and energy level than the people who say, oh, I'm going to stay put at home. So properly done, immigration can be a positive. And so instead of having sort of a semi-out-of-control system, and then what we did for decades, which was morally wrong, was turned a blind eye to the needs of the economy, you know, for agricultural workers, for other kinds of people in construction and elsewhere, and sort of turned a blind eye and a wink to illegal immigration, which was wrong from terms of law, but also wrong in the fact that sort of puts a ceiling on people if you're not here documented. You got to always be kind of looking over your shoulder. And that's an inhibiting factor of moving up. It's like an informal economy. If you don't make it easy to start or grow a business, yeah, you reach a certain size and then you figure better keep your head down before the authorities come after you. So change needs to be there, but we need immigration, if only because it helps vitalize an economy. And again, if you have a vibrant economy, you know, low taxes, sensible regulation, stable dollar, stable currency, by golly, these people become not taking away from existing citizens, but actually contributing to their well-being, the immigrants' well-being, and the well-being of everyone else. It becomes a positive. But if you have a stagnant economy, then you can say, oh, they're coming in and we're competing for a small pie instead of an expanding pie.
Right. And we did see the pie expanding under President Trump. But yeah. I want to say the one area where he didn't embrace the free market is with a bunch of trade tariffs. And don't you think that it would have been even better and reached higher heights without kind of the destructive fallout from the trade war?
Yeah. Tariff is another word for sales tax. So when you hear things like 25% tariffs on automobiles, that's a 25% sales tax. That's sort of sharply focuses the thing. So call it for what it is. And for those who violate trade agreements, as the Chinese did, there are other measures you can take. Measures against companies that are violating the rules or laundering money, sanctions against individuals. There are a lot of things you can do to punish wrongdoing and make it clear you expect people who sign agreements to adhere to those agreements than putting a tax on yourself. So I didn't mind him going after the abuses of a country like China. I just don't think putting a sales tax on, which we end up paying for, was the best way to do it. So it wasn't the ends, it was the means. And on the trade thing, yeah, I was never a tariff fan at all. Smoot-Hawley, bad.
No, I'm on the same page as you. And I would like to see the president change his tune on that, but I don't know that he will. One thing that I think really I was disappointed was that in 2016, when Republicans had unified government, they did not take in serious steps to rein in the budget or the out-of-control deficit. That's not all on President Trump. A lot of that's on Congress. But is that a failure, right? Because the economy did well, but wouldn't it have done better if we'd started to get this behemoth runaway debt out of control, if we'd started to rein that back in?
Yeah, when you talk about deficit reduction, you have to make very clear you're not advocating new or higher taxes. That's always their default position. No, we spending don't want cuts. That. And on the spending side, there are two ways to do it. I like to call it the root canal without anesthesia approach, or the more positive growth approach. The two big drivers of spending are healthcare and Social Security. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is the biggest one by far. And you can get positive, you don't have to cut benefits. What you have to do is recognize on the healthcare side, and this is a whole different topic, is that we don't have real free markets in healthcare. It's all a third party system. And when the customer is not in control, it goes crazy. A hospital, for example, knows that its money revenues come from how well it negotiates with insurance companies and with the government, Medicare, Medicaid. Not with how they satisfy the customer, which is why you have hospitals putting two sick people in the same room with a curtain in between, or those robes you get that, you know, you need a manual to put on, and they're all as ugly as hell. No spa would have something like that, because the patient's not the customer. It's sort of out of control. And if you look, and so as a result of third party, instead of these third party intermediaries helping you, the poor patient, navigate the system, it ends up grossly inflating the costs of the system and giving you worse care, over testing and the like. Johns Hopkins has found the third highest cause of death in this country. You don't see it on death certificates, but you can guess from the death certificate, is medical errors.
Really?
250,000 a year. We still have tens of thousands of people dying unnecessarily in hospitals because of infections that could be prevented. So there you want transparency, you want more patient control. But this gets to this question on spending. As you get more real free market reforms in the healthcare industry, which is starting to come because companies are now putting more and more high deductible plans, so you're paying more out of pocket than ever before. You're starting to see what the prices are that they're charging for this stuff. You're going to start to see the creation of a real consumer market and information and sites to tell you, you can get an MRI for $300 at this place and $3,000 at that place. That's price. That's great information. So to get to Medicare and Medicaid, which are huge drivers now in terms of spending on the state level and on the federal level, you start to get real free markets in there. You start to change the whole model of the healthcare industry. Those things will take care of themselves, especially in allowing states more freedom to do different things with Medicaid. Indiana, for example, is introducing the concept of health savings accounts. It got a special exemption from the government to start to do that. And they did it with their state employees several years ago. Mike Pence did it before he went to Washington from the governorship in the Medicaid area. Well, when they did it with state employees, health savings accounts properly done, the costs went down 35% and the outcomes were the same or better. So you're not taking anything away from any. So long story short, it's a long answer, but it's critically important. Deal with the systemic problems of healthcare, huge one. And on Social Security, we can pay the benefits for those who are on the system and those who are going to go on the system for the next 20 years. The key thing is younger people like you, and you should have a system where a chunk of your payroll tax goes to your own personal account.
Right.
Your labor created it. You own it, not the Washington politicians. And you get to determine when you want to retire. You want to do it at 61, fine. If you want to wait to 101, go right ahead. And it's yours. If you want to put in your will that it goes to your pet rabbit, fine. If you want to do it to your spouse, fine. It's your property.
So don't worry. I am not counting on getting a dime from Social Security.
By the way, the current system ends up destroying capital, whereas a personal account system would be creating capital.
There you go.
Profound change.
So I guess kind of one final serious question that will maybe round out this conversation is, looking at the next 4 years, if Trump is reelected, what do you think the most important visions for his economic agenda would need to be?
Continuing on deregulation, utterly unglamorous, and start to push for principles-based regulation. Where, as I mentioned with the molten salt, you say, here are the goals, go ahead and do it. And if you don't do it, you will be fined or punished or whatever, but we're not going to micromanage how you do it. Here's what needs to be done. And that's a principles base is a better way to go. Another thing that they've sort of started to do in Washington, in terms I'm just talking about getting the beast under control, is take Washington and spread it around the country. Why not move most of the ag department to Kansas or Iowa? Why not move the FDA to Boston? I mean, you know, start to get, why is it all clustered in one place? Makes it easier for lobbyists and everybody else. Mm-hmm. Spread it around the country. And I think that would be healthy just in terms of people dealing with real people in real places. But the key thing is deregulation and doing it in a more sweeping way. And the other key thing is moving ahead on taxes. I would love to see the flat tax, serious tax reform, real simplification and rate reduction. And also start to pay more attention to the Federal Reserve and stable dollar. Because you can get these other things right, but if the dollar becomes unstable, as we saw in the 70s, bad things are going to happen. So, and on the trade side, punish the wrongdoers. Let's stay away from those tariffs. And, you know,
because you and I get to pay for them at the consumer checkout. And we'll have to have you back sometime for a deep dive on the monetary policy. But I want to round out our conversation with kind of a fun question I ask everybody. I was just talking today about how I saw on Twitter, and I really want to try it, pizza with candy corn baked on the top. So what is your kind of grossest food preference that you like that other people think is gross or crazy?
Well, I certainly would like that. I think places like McDonald's and all the new burger places we're getting are advances in civilization. And I don't consider them junk food. I consider them nice convenience foods. I love peanut butter with bacon.
Oh.
On toast.
Wow. Okay. I feel like people will have some strong opinions on that one. But Mr. Forbes, thank you so much for your time and for coming on the show.
Yeah, I hope you don't have nutritionists listening to you.
All right.
Good to be with you, Brad. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, everybody. That's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. And make sure that you're subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. And if you can do one thing to help us out and show us some love, be sure to go to the iTunes Store, the Apple Podcasts app, and give us a 5-star rating and leave us a nice review. We really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next week.